Recently, John Foster Dulles resigned as Secretary of State, and Christian A. Herta has succeeded him in office. The circumstances under which Mr. Dulles resigned are deeply regretted by everyone. He is a gravely sick man, and the prayers of all men of goodwill are with him in his great ailment. Whether one agreed or disagreed with his policies in office, no one could question his integrity, his patriotism, his dedication. He brought to his tasks strong and honest convictions, and he gave to his country the fullest measure of unselfish devotion in a trying and critical period in the history of the world. It is too soon for history to make a final evaluation of his role or to pass a verdict on the success or failure of his career as Secretary of State. Nearly all the issues with which he dealt are still in a very fluid state. No final solution to any international problem has yet been reached, and the wisdom of his insights and judgments and actions are yet to be either justified or challenged by coming events. In a sense, when you come to think of it, in a sense, a final evaluation may never be made, and if made, may never be universally accepted. In times such as these, times of global reconstruction, reorganization, times seething with revolutionary social and political ideas and experiments, which will require not months or years to reconcile or to compose, but actually generations. In such times, which, to quote Edwin Markham, the poet, humanity betrayed, plundered, profaned, and disinherited, cries protest to the judges of the world, a protest that is also prophecy. In such times, no one, no man, in charge of the foreign policies of the United States, confronted with many, if not most, of the problems of such confused and perilous times, no one can be credited either with total success or charged with total failure. The affairs of the world are too vast, too complex, too extended and continuous in time and space for any one man, for any one country, to encompass them fully and to regulate them and arrange them. The best that one can hope for is that the leadership of such a man placed in such high office or of such a country, that their leadership in world affairs could not be altogether so wrong-headed and blundering as to be seriously injurious, or at best, that they give mankind some slight forward push in the right direction. Some slight forward push in the right direction. I watched the other night a television program in which Field Marshal Viscount Montgomery of Great Britain was being interviewed. In the course of a very interesting and provocative hour's interview, this famous military leader delivered himself of many timely and apt observations on the pressing issues confronting mankind today. And with many of his opinions, I found myself, as I'm sure you have and many others, I found myself in full agreement. He spoke, among other things, of America's post-war world leadership. He thought that it had been intermittent, not as good as it might be, rather suspect, characterized by lack of decision at the top level. And with those opinions, I believe most Americans would readily agree. I doubt, however, that they would go along with Montgomery in his opinion that American leadership had slipped a little because President Eisenhower and former Secretary of State Dulles and now Secretary Herter aren't very well, very fit physically. Now the foreign policies of these men were not very different after their illnesses than before their illnesses. And these foreign policies, in the main, did not differ very much from those of their predecessors in office. And I believe that very few Americans would go on with Marshal Montgomery when he set out to extol the British world leadership above American leadership. The British, he declared, had the experience of centuries in world leadership. But the United States had quite a bit to learn. And here one is inclined to ask, how did the British do with this experience of centuries? What did they do with it? Munich, Chamberlain, and the prelude to the Second World War. And before Munich, did this experience of the centuries lead them indirectly to contribute to the triumph of the Axis over democracy in Spain and the destruction of the Spanish Republic? And after Munich, did this experience of centuries lead to Bevan and Palestine and the blundering policies there, which finally led to the surrender of the mandate? And generally speaking, what about this experience of centuries in the case of India and the disintegration of the British Empire? No, I am afraid the hope of the world today does not lie with the more consistent leadership of Great Britain, as the Marshal suggests, has not been and there is not likely to be any such consistent leadership there or elsewhere in the free world. We all have made their serious mistakes and they will all continue to make serious mistakes. The most that the world can hope for, the free world, is that collectively the free world will profit from its past mistakes and will be more flexible, less dogmatic, less penny-wise and pound-foolish, and more courageous in their loyalty to their own basic traditions of freedom and justice and human equality. And we hope that our new Secretary of State, Mr. Herter, will bring to his difficult tasks a measure of this very flexibility of which I am speaking, this willingness to try a new approach, which even some of the friends of Mr. Dulles found lacking in him. We've had a firm and inflexible line, and that was to surround and contain the Soviet Union. We attempted to encircle it with a solid military wall. And to that end, we made many military pacts and alliances. Even with our former enemies, even with countries under dictatorships. We made, for example, former Nazi Germany, or the western part of it. We made it central in our defense plan of Europe against communism. And we poured our arms and we poured our billions into it. We rearmed Germany and are rearming Germany. Although in 1945, after the Second World War at Potsdam, we had agreed with our allies to demilitarize Germany completely, we decided all war potentials, war plans, aircrafts, arms, warships, everything should be completely destroyed, so that Germany would never again be able to make war upon the rest of the world. But today we are thinking not only of providing arms to Germany, and have been providing arms to Germany, we're actually considering giving Germany guided missiles and nuclear warheads. We are doing for Germany after the Second World War what some of the Allies did for Hitler after the First World War, in the fond hope that Hitler would fight and destroy communism for them. Hitler actually made an alliance with communist Russia. And when this no longer served his purpose, he broke that alliance. And later on, Hitler was helped to his destruction by this very Russian communism, working in cooperation with the United States and the free nations of the world. Our efforts to contain the Soviet Union have not been successful. In the last 5 years, the Soviet Union has made substantial gains outside Europe, in the Near East, in the Far East, in Africa, not through military penetration, but through economic and cultural penetration and through skillful propaganda. In Europe, communism has made no advances since 1948, influence of communist parties, the great communist parties in Italy, for example, and in France, has actually declined. But not because of our military alliances against Russia, but because communism has no basic appeal for Western Europe, and the conditions are not congenial there for its spread. And neutralism, that is the determination of smaller peoples not to become involved in the power struggle between the East and the West, is gaining ground, even in Europe, and certainly in Asia and Africa. In their worlds of poverty and overpopulation, they are not impressed, these peoples, by our cry to rally to the defense of democracy against dictatorship, or to free enterprise against state socialism. They want food and clothing and schools and hospitals, regardless of who helps them to get them. And they want peace. Of course, all of our military experts also want peace. But these military experts are in the main convinced that only maximum military preparedness for war will ensure peace. The fact, of course, which is contradicted by everything that's happened in history up to today, maximum military preparedness never prevented war and never will. And believing as they do, these military leaders of the free countries, the countries who can extend aid and relief, they arm all these countries to whom aid and relief are extended. Arm them with weapons of war and insist upon bringing them into a network of military alliances. And most of these nations don't want it. And it is precisely here that communist propaganda scores heavily. It is precisely here that is the most fertile soil for the Cold War. And our own most generous foreign aid is most suspect. Therefore, it is my humble opinion, and that of many others, of course, that because the old rigid line of containing communism through military alliances and through an armament race, because it has not been successful, and Russia is rapidly catching up with us in nuclear weapons and intercontinental missiles, and in some categories is already out distant us. In our judgment, it is now imperative to shift the emphasis. And some of our allies have already recognized this fact. We must no longer make antagonism to the Soviet our chief preoccupation. Rather, we must explore every promising avenue for living peacefully in the same world with the Soviet Union and with the other communist states whose joint population exceeds those of the free world. We must not remain prisoners of our own propaganda of the past, because the old way, the old line, can lead only to the abyss. There is no other alternative but to try a new approach. War, everyone says, is unthinkable. It will mean the end of mankind, and no military man, unless he is deranged, will today advocate war must of course mean nuclear war as a means of destroying communism. I came across the other day this information, this prognostication of what a nuclear war would mean. Dr. Pauling of California, Nobel Prize man, foreign member of the Royal Society, writes as follows. We may get a good idea of what would happen to the United States in a nuclear war from the testimony given before the Special Subcommittee on Radiation of the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy by Dr. William W. Kellogg, Mr. Charles Schaeffer. They described in some detail the predicted effects of an hypothetical attack on the United States with thermonuclear weapons. This analysis has led to the conclusion that over one half of the people in the United States would be dead at the end of 60 days after the attack as a result of the injuries received during the first 24 hours. The additional radiation effect during the period after 24 hours might be such as to cause the deaths of some additional millions or tens of millions. I conclude that in contemplating a possible nuclear war, writes Dr. Spaulding, we should estimate that between one half and three quarters of the people of the United States would be dead at the end of 60 days. Now, the figures are so staggering, you just can't grasp them at all. Let us make an estimate for the world as a whole. Casualties might well be as great proportionately in the USSR, with 225 million people, in Europe as a whole with 425 million, and in some of the adjacent regions in which there may be military bases, altogether. About 1 billion people in the world might be in the regions in which there would be heavy nuclear attack. Between one half and three quarters of this total might be dead within 60 days after the attack. That is between 500 million and 750 million. Now the danger, of course, is not that a nation deliberately will set in motion a nuclear war. The danger, as Prime Minister Harold Macmillan pointed out the other day, stem not from the intent of any nation to start a nuclear war, but rather from accident, from miscalculation, from a strain on someone's nerves, from some mistake. Someone will pull the trigger or push the button too soon. Now it is clear that we must reduce the tensions of the world and put a stop to this mad race in nuclear weapons, which threatens the very survival of humanity. The test will come, or a test will come next week in Geneva, when the foreign ministers of the East and the West will meet to discuss Berlin, Germany, perhaps other problems affecting the peace of the world. Now the question which presents itself to us is, will these foreign ministers meet, as they have met in the past, only to repeat old slogans, worn out ideological cliches and catchphrases, and utter mutual recriminations, as they've done in the past, for propaganda purposes, and for the press and radio back home? Or will they, as prayerfully hope, earnestly and sincerely make a fresh start towards reasonable negotiations, having in mind the future as well as the present, in a spirit not of competitive Cold War, but in a spirit of give and take, and thus pave the way for a summit conference where major agreements can really be reached, which may tend to tranquilize our world and remove the danger of man's total undoing. Berlin is important, and so is Germany, but not nearly as important as humanity. The present arrangement for Berlin, the present status of Berlin, is a part of the post-war exigencies, the contingencies which followed the Second World War. It was never regarded as a permanent settlement or as a logical settlement for that purpose. A divided Berlin, administered by an inter-allied governing authority with representatives of each of the four powers, is an anomaly, as is a divided Germany generally. And certainly a solution can be found, but not as long as Russia will think of East Germany as an advanced military outpost for the Soviet, and not as long as the Allies will think of West Germany as a military outpost for it, and will be hoping for the unification of Germany so that it might join NATO as part of the European, Western European defense system against the Soviet Union. Russia will never permit it. Russia fears Germany and will never permit Germany to become a member of NATO. Now Germany can be unified, now or by stages through a federation of the two Germanies, but only if it is neutralized and all foreign armed forces are withdrawn from it. This would have been far easier to do 5 or 10 years ago, but it is not yet too late. And the West has no reason to fear such a federation, because the West is in possession of 2/3 of the territory of Germany and 3/4 of the population of Germany and most of the industrial resources. Back in 1951, I spoke here at the Temple on "Shall We Rearm Germany?", an address which was published at the time. And in this address, I said, expressing my opinion then, the decision of Potsdam taken by Truman, Churchill, and Stalin was a wise decision. It was dictated by real statesmanship. Germany should never be rearmed. It should be permanently demilitarized. And like Switzerland, it should be neutralized. The North Atlantic Pact nations and the Soviet bloc of nations should agree to neutralize Germany. The armies of the Allies and of the Soviet Union should be withdrawn from Germany. East and West Germany should be permitted to reunite. The present division is unnatural. If it is permitted to remain, it will be a source of never-ending conflict and political disturbance in the heart of Europe. A united and militarized Germany will be a menace to the world. A united and demilitarized Germany may be a way of pacifying the whole continent of Europe. The German people will then have the opportunity to rebuild their life if they so desire, on truly democratic lines and in peaceful ways. And all the events of the last 8 years seem to have substantiated this approach. And if this can be accomplished, the summit conference, preceded by this conference of the foreign secretaries, ministers, if this can be accomplished, other steps of pacification in other areas of the world will follow. And other conferences, summit conferences, and foreign minister conferences will be held. And we shall be entering an era of lessening tensions. And then agreements on large-scale general disarmament may be possible. This, in my humble judgment, is political realism. All else is what someone has called doctrinaire incompetence. There is no victory possible in the world today except the victory of compromise. A total victory in war means a total defeat for everyone. My prayer for hope is our own beloved country and its new Secretary of State will be able to give this kind of new, positive, helpful, courageous leadership in the world today.